may have heard the kids are getting radical, at least compared to older voters. Among Americans 18 to 34, socialism is viewed more positively than capitalism. In the 2020 presidential election, 54% of Democratic voters under 30 back Bernie Sanders, a Democratic socialist. Sanders won 65% of voters under 30 in the Nevada caucuses.
Thank you!
Why are you a socialist?
You know, I'm originally from West Virginia, and so every time I go home, you see the trees are gone. Cold dust covers the roads, but like no one's life is improving there.
Connor McClellan co-founded a Young Democratic Socialist for America chapter at East Tennessee State University in September 2018. Connor and 11 other members of the group road-tripped 14 hours from Johnson City, Tennessee for a three-day conference.
Hello, everyone. This is Connor McClellan.
We're passing through Indianapolis, and we're excited to be in Chicago.
You don't expect like a bunch of like young socialists to be in the middle of Tennessee, but I think we're like one of the biggest political clubs on campus.
275 college and high school students gathered in Chicago to learn how to be better organizers for democratic socialism and for Bernie Sanders.
So this is a little Yolidarity. It's about Southern socialism. So this is to raise awareness that, you know, there are leftist movements in red states.
The conference is run by Democratic Socialists of America, which has been around since the early 1980s.
When we fight,
we win!
When we fight,
we win!
But there was a surge in interest after the 2016 election, and in the last 3 years, membership has more than doubled from 24,000 people to 56,000.
Radical, extreme, far-left socialists have now taken over.
The Democratic Party today is a radical socialist party.
What do you say to people who say you're radical?
I don't think it's radical to believe that everyone should have access to health care. I don't think it's radical to believe people can have free access to college. That happens in European states. So no, I don't believe I'm radical.
Many of the students we talked to at the conference said watching their parents struggle as they grew up is what drew them to Sanders.
I come from an immigrant family. I've seen my parents work so hard for things that should have been afforded to them as soon as they got here, things like Medicare, things like affordable housing, things like access to secondary education.
My sister and I did not have health care for a long time. So I remember growing up just knowing I wouldn't be able to go to the doctor if I needed to.
My dad the other day actually, so he was like, why do you support Bernie Sanders? He supports Donald Trump. I asked my dad, when's the last time you've had health care? He said, I have never had health care. And he's almost 60 years old. At the end, I just said, Dad, I support Bernie Sanders because I support you.
You may be wondering what these college students are so upset about. The economy is strong and unemployment is 3.6%. But behind those numbers are some troubling facts. The average college grad in debt now owes almost $30,000. 60% of personal bankruptcies are at least partially caused by medical debt. And wages are not increasing as fast as housing costs. Almost 40% of renter households are paying more than a third of their income in rent. According to the DSA, Democratic Socialists believe that capitalism has given too much power to too few people, and that there should be more democratic control over the economy.
I want to see workers have a say in the jobs that they do, and not simply be treated as cogs in a machine, expendable.
Coal companies have so much money, they extract all the wealth from the state and don't reinvest anything. And like, I grew up seeing that as a kid, and every time I go back, it's like it gets worse. There has to be more regulation. There has to be like a vision for the future in which the people who work are valued higher than they are now.
We should not be giving any more tax breaks to large corporations.
When Sanders ran for president in 2016, he lost. But he changed what these students thought was politically possible.
What he has given us is not just him as like a personality. He has given us just, I don't know, this incredible power that after Bernie Sanders, there will be something more.
Some Democratic candidates are nervous the socialism tag would be ballot box poison.
I am troubled by having a socialist lead our ticket.
And that Trump would use it to scare more moderate voters.
Donald Trump is desperate to pin the socialist label of socialists, socialists, socialists on our party. We can't let him do that.
And older Americans might wonder why Sanders has gotten so much support from this demographic when a fresh-faced candidate like Pete Buttigieg is in the race.
So Pete Buttigieg is a millennial. Okay. Why don't you like him?
It's so simple-minded to think that just because he's a young guy means he represents something different.
I don't think he's sincere, I don't think he's genuine, and I don't think he's gonna bring America what it needs.
What about Mike Bloomberg?
Mike Bloomberg,
No, Mike Bloomberg's a no for me.
Another capitalist, a capitalist who I think is actually scarier than Donald Trump.
To me, he seems like he's buying votes.
If Bernie Sanders isn't the Democratic nominee, will you vote in the election?
Bernie Sanders will be the Democratic nominee. So I'll be voting for him in the election, yeah.
But there is a chance he doesn't get it right. So if it's someone like Bloomberg, what will you do?
I'll vote my conscience.
Okay.
But I will be voting for Bernie Sanders.
Okay.
Yeah.
Class war, class war, class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
My attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. It's your brother, Brian Mandis. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield podcast segment. Oh, what a difference a couple of years make. What a difference a couple of years make. This is going to be a very interestingly difficult, well, you can tell by the title, segment. It's going to be unusual. Because, ladies and gentlemen, what I'm doing is I'm retracting and renouncing socialism on this episode, this episode segment, sorry. And here, and I have some reasons. I've been thinking about this for probably the last 10 months, maybe even a little bit longer. I started having some doubts. Now, I like what Sweden's doing. So it's not necessarily a reflection on them. If truth could be told, and it should be, Morris Berman pushed me over the edge, I think, of coming to terms with this. And I've been trying to parse through my emotions and thoughts. And really my thoughts, because I really don't have any emotional connection to this, which is nice. But I've been trying to really parse through my thoughts, like, why do I want to disavow socialism? And the truest of true statements that I can speak as to answering the question why is simply this. It won't work. Not in America. The reason I believe it works so well in Sweden is because the people in Sweden have a very unique and very concentrated history. They see themselves as similar enough to take care of one another. Moreover, because their century was really unraveled over the course of the last, you know, X amount of thousands of years in a way that put them into a position to be literally neutral, during, wait, am I getting my, yeah, yes, I'm getting this correct. To be literally neutral with some of the, largest wars of mankind, to put them in a position to be a voice of reason without exerting power in Europe, in a way that would be seen as authoritarian or dominating. This says that they are a very special, unique country. And that type of socialism, which would work for a people dedicated to holding themselves together, is not going to function in the United States. Moreover, the socialist concept that many indigenous people had throughout the world, which is why the United States, playing the role of evil empire, went in and smashed those movements, that type of socialism won't work here either. Why? Because the United States, the population, doesn't have that depth of spiritual intelligence necessary to not only implement that type of socialism, which is really deeply rooted in the family, which is rooted in the tribe, which is rooted in customs and cultures that go back thousands of years, and sometimes hundreds of thousands of years, and sometimes longer than that. The United States citizenry does not have that in them. Moreover, and I think, so I'd have to go back longer than 10 months ago, I think this is when my understanding of socialism shifted drastically. When I was listening to Matt Stoller's Goliath, he has a section in there where he talks about socialism and what the types of socialism people were fighting about at the beginning of the 1900s, the end of the 1800s, and the majority of the socialism concepts, socialistic concepts that people were fighting over, they were often more aligned with either what the USSR did or what Franklin Roosevelt did. That's why Franklin Roosevelt could do what he did, and a lot of socialists were, not all of them, but a lot of them were all in, because he started to go down that path. Now, he did it for the right reasons. He did it because if he didn't, then, yeah, the shirt was going to be lost off of the American elite's back. But he did it. That type of socialism, knowing the history of the United States, knowing the history of Europe altogether, the people who came over here came from various different backgrounds, but a lot of those backgrounds have very hierarchically structured cultures and traditions, which I believe would result often, especially in a situation where you had to be cross-cultural, which is what you'd have to be in the United States, that would render each culture fighting for their peace. And ultimately, it would result, especially at the top of the society, in strongman rule. We were already doomed for that experience when the Founding Fathers decided to use Rome as a exemplar for their government mechanisms. But this tradition of hierarchically based societies is too interwoven and has not been, to a large extent, killed off. You know, you don't have to kill everything in a tradition, but the idea of seeing your neighbor as your enemy, that had to be done away with if America was going to be able to do some kind of socialistic commonwealth agenda, which points me to another revelation which I had. This country does not, in its culture, have a definition of commonwealth. And the reason it doesn't have a definition of commonwealth is because for the better part of 200 years, well, no, it'd have to go significantly more than that. Even when it was a colony, so probably the better part of 300 years, what the people who moved across this land were worried about was, quote, settling it. They were worried about conquering it. They were worried about taking it away from somebody. So thus, there was no time to really develop a coherent and strong culture except for give me. That's the culture of the United States. And if the country had had time to develop a more strict, a more communal-oriented culture instead of a constant push, 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 you know, gimme, 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 take, 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 culture, yeah, then you might be able to have a commonwealth concept. But this country does not have a commonwealth concept. And without a commonwealth concept in your culture, a deeply ingrained commonwealth concept in your culture, you're never going to be able to develop a socialistic concept. The same is true in governing. For the life of me, ladies and gentlemen, I do not understand why people are so fixated on fooling themselves about the government of the United States. The government of the United States has always been in complete and utter disarray. It has always been a tool of the wealthy. And people seem to think that this is something new. No, if you read about the Founding Fathers, you see fragmentation immediately. Significant fragmentation. And if you continue reading about the Founding Fathers, you see that because the Constitution is hailed as being some great document, ladies and gentlemen, the Constitution did the bare minimum. The bare minimum. Okay, the bare minimum of setting up an actual governing system. There is detail, but there's a lot of non-detail. And you can tell just how flimsy the Constitution is by starting to look at your state constitutions. Oh, well, that was the reason because they didn't want an overburdening federal government. Yeah, but if you plan on building a country which is expansive, you need to have clearly defined rules on how your governing structure is going to expand. And I'm not here just talking about, adding members to the lower house or the upper house and things like that. I'm talking about adding departments. I'm talking about defining departments, defining the roles of cabinet members and things like that. No, they chose to do that in other places. And I believe that takes away from the Constitution. Because, if you look at the Founding Fathers, the major issue that you see is that they were pretty much making it up on the fly. And you would say, well, of course they were. They were, they were building a country and they didn't know what the heck they were doing. Ladies and gentlemen, despite what people tell you, most of the people who founded this country were not ignorant people. Okay? Some of them, a number of them, had significant legal backgrounds. Or at least enough to know. And supposedly, one of the founding fathers supposedly did all this grand research before offering up a plan of organizing the United States. He went and he looked at what the Native Americans were doing. He went and looked at what the Romans, the Greeks, the other people had done. And then he supposedly built a system based on what he read. It's absolute bollocks. If you look at what he came up with, there's no way that he just didn't go to the Romans and say, I like this, write that down, do this, do that, and here you go. It's completely from Rome. So when you have a structure, a governing structure, which doesn't have a commonwealth principle, the preamble of the United States Constitution is flimsy. And yet, note, one of the most prominent things that they put forward is that the Constitution is for security. Why is it for security? Because they were going to be going and expanding into Native American territory, and they needed the federal government to be there to tamp down Native American resistance. That's one of the primary reasons security is there. When you have a Constitution that is built on such flimsy grounds without actually defining what you mean, then guess what? You can attach any definition that you want to those meanings. And I sometimes ponder if that's actually what the founding fathers wanted. They wanted people to have wide interpretations. Why? Because these were people of means. They had a lot of money. And they knew that they themselves had wide interpretations of what this stuff should mean. And thus, they wanted to allow people in the future to have wide interpretation. Yeah, well, that's great and grand when you're living in an agrarian society with land and stuff being the most beneficial and profitable estate. But these people were supposed to be visionaries. They knew, because of what was happening in Europe at the time, they knew that there was going to be massive industrialization, there were going to be massive changes in various other things. They knew this. And yet they left flimsy instructions as to how to deal with this stuff. So with such a depravity at the center of even constitutional concepts, with such a depravity when it comes to the Constitution, in social, cultural concepts, because the Constitution doesn't help out with trying to define government in social, cultural context, you don't have the binding strength necessary to make even Swedish-style socialism possible. Now, does this mean that I don't believe socialism can work here in the United States? It does mean I don't believe socialism can work. Socialism, as defined by Europe, for most of Europe, still maintains a very hierarchically rigid structure. And in a hierarchically rigid structure, you're going to always have, and Europe has proved this, they do this wonderfully, you're going to have class and caste. The caste part mixed with the class came from Rome. Rome was very good at doing that. Now, they had a very interesting way of mixing the two, if you would. And Europe inherited that and continued that. A really good way of looking at class and caste is the church had a caste, okay? They implemented a caste system in Europe, and then within the individual countries, there was class systems. And then sometimes you would have in individual countries additional caste systems, which, you know, your kings, your noble people, and then your peasants. That was a caste. And even as you rose through the ranks, if you rose through the ranks, oftentimes, you know, you would still carry that badge of being a peasant, you know, until maybe one or two generations later when it would finally fall off your heirs. So America is an inheritor of that. They take in all of that. Plus, around the world, you have to understand, socialism is not a new system. It's not a new system. From everything that I've read about Native Indigenous people on this continent, they lived in a very socialistic society. I've read about tribes in Africa that live in very socialistic societies. And these societies are strongly, strongly Commonwealth-oriented. The Commonwealth is within the individual, within the family, within the friendship, within the social bonds, within the society, within the interactions between the tribe and other tribes. A Commonwealth is a matter of honor. It is deeply, deeply, deeply sacred. And I know we often do not associate honor with Africa, but there are tribal traditions of honor which destroy if you cross them up. I mean, to dishonor somebody in many of these tribes in Africa is akin to spitting in their face. And Europeans actually know this, and they take advantage of that. So let me not even get into that because it just will throw off everything. But, and actually, no, let me get into that because I wonder sometimes if this has to do with what's going on with Europeans, exploiting Europeans. So Europeans will hire some person to be a manager of some extraction operation in Africa. And they will say, they'll use this person to change the definition of honor, which part of the definition of honor is if there's a task to be done, you know, you're supposed to do your fair share. Well, Europeans will go in and say, well, if you and your whole tribe do this for me, if you and, you know, 500 men or what have you do this for me, I'll give you X amount of dollars per head for doing this. Obviously, they absolutely rip these people off because, you know, psychopaths and everything. But that's what they do. And because of the strict code of honor within the tribe, and those of you who are like, wait a minute, did you just really call them psychopaths and just leave that sitting there? Yeah, when you do this kind of stuff, this is psychopathic. You can't have it like, I'm a human, but I'm going to cheat you and steal stuff from you and culturally appropriate you and all this other stuff and, you know, not lose an ounce of sleep and then come to me and say, I'm a humanitarian. Yeah, no. Psychopath. So, continuing. So they go, and they'll start doing the work, and inevitably, somebody out of that 500 is going to be like, guys, we're getting screwed here. Do you realize, like, do you see what we're pulling out of the ground? And we're giving back to these people, and they're, like, giving us $2. What are we doing? And then the person who was hired would say, you're dishonoring us by not doing your fair share. Shut up. That really happens, y'all. That really happens. And by the way, if that sounds a little bit familiar to you, well, yeah, that's because the idea of honor isn't something new. It's, if you go back far enough in most cultures, there's an honor code, but it's gotten twisted as more things have become about money, 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 money. Anyway, Anyway, when you strip that honor code, you strip the bonds that are necessary for a socialistic concept. In these cultures, these tribal cultures, socialism is lived. It's not in a governing ideology. It is part of the social fabric which keeps everything alive. So socialism is almost a cultural necessity in order to make everything else flow. And I just do not see that happening in the United States. So far as I could tell, is really that America, its model really should be for the love of money. America, for the love of riches. America. What does Puerto Rico mean? Anyway, I gotta look that up. I've been wondering that for a long time. But, socialism is not American enough. It's not adaptable to America enough for it to work here. Now, in the black community, we used to be very socialistic until we started imitating far too much and drinking in the cultural toxicity far too much of white people. Then we started breaking apart our communities just like they had done to theirs. I mean, granted, crack helped a lot. That war against black people helped a lot because that's what crack was. It was a war against black people, y'all. But, hey, I digress. I mean, I find it always constantly amazing that crack cocaine was introduced into the black community at the same time gangster rap was, which allowed them to lock black people up and then, you know, pound us with a consumer-based culture. Something that we'd never engaged in before. I mean, we had always wanted stuff, but not to the extent that we want it now. We've become defined by our consumer-based goods. And just to let you know, because this is often forgotten about, I believe that in the 50s and 60s, as consumerism was spreading throughout this country and became kind of the de facto cultural cue in this country, you had a lot of people, a lot of parents and stuff who were medicating themselves. Now, most of the medications that they were taking was, you know, wine, scotch, things like that. But their children, who grew up, especially in the 50s, suddenly, in order to deal with the emptiness of the world, started taking a whole bunch of drugs. So, I ponder sometime if, you know, drugs was needed to make consumption possible. You could go back to the 1800s, the late 1800s, and see the amount of drugs that were being pumped into American mouths via medicines and cures for what was ail people. Basically, what was happening was people were depressed because of industrialization, and in order to keep them non-depressed, they would be given beer, very stout beer that makes, I guess, today's stuff seem funny, almost like water, or so I would remember being told at a, I went on a tour years ago when I was a kid, and they were talking about it, forgot where, but anyway, but also, you know, people were given a a lot of other things like cocaine and heroin. Maybe not heroin. That I think came a lot later. But there's one I'm missing and I can't think of it. Morphine. Or there's a product that was made that then would be metastasized into morphine by the liver, blah, blah, blah. Basically, they drugged people into accepting their station in life. And this is a repeated cycle or a repeated theme in American history. Look at today. Everyone's like, oh my God, you know, people are on so many drugs. White people are on so many drugs. That's why we're so concerned about it. You know. But people are on so much drugs. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you know, the 70s, people were on a lot of drugs. 60s, people were on a lot of drugs. The 20s, people were on a lot of drugs. The 1890s, people on a lot of drugs. Hell, the early 1900s, people were on a lot of drugs. I think the late 1880s, people were on a lot of drugs. I mean, this has just been something, especially since industrialization took over in this country. So that's just a side note that I'm going to add there. But the cultural depravity of this country it really makes putting something like socialism in place difficult. Because you don't have the depth of unity, of purpose, that other countries have. Basically, the whole purpose of the United States is to consume, 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 and consume. We don't even have a proper recycling structure in this country. And when I say recycling structure, for God's sakes, I'm talking about a real-to-bones recycling structure. What do I mean? Why haven't we been building or creating biodegradable materials? Why isn't everything that we make biodegradable? Because it's cheaper for it not to be. Okay, well then, yeah, that's a problem. If you create a system, which this is what has happened, if you create a system where it's cheaper to build something that's going to pollute than to build something that's not going to pollute. Ladies and gentlemen, what that is telling you is that your system is built for pollution and destruction's sake. That is the ultimate goal of what it is that you are doing. You're just trying to pollute. You're trying to destroy. You're trying to lay waste to. And socialism, especially as indigenous people have lived it, socialism doesn't allow that to happen. You have to look for the good. You have to look for the common good. You cannot do something just because you want to do it. It is profitable to do what is good. It is unprofitable to do what is bad. Even if financially it costs you less to do the bad, it is still unprofitable. This is why, for instance, wealthy people fight so hard against a VAT tax, a value-added tax, is because in the value-added tax legislation that is used in Europe all over the place, there is regulations that are put in place that ensure that the quality of the product doesn't take away from the social good. And it's all up and down the line. So if you were using cheap labor overseas, you might actually have to pay some taxes on that in the country. If you were using products that are more harmful when they're disposed of, you might have to pay some taxes on that in the product. If you are not paying your people a living wage, you gotta pay some taxes on that. That's why they fight against these things. Consciousness is required to to run a socialistic country. And I'm talking about multi-level here. I'm talking about social intelligence at its greatest. Consciousness is required to see the multiple dimensions of the society and how they should fit together to not only create a commonwealth, but how they should fit together to keep intact the beauty of the multiplicity in the society. What I mean by multiplicity is the word we think of as diverse, which I don't necessarily like that word, because verse has a very, there's a negative connotation with verse, and then when you add die to it, it's kind of, but every culture wants to be protected, especially when that culture is beneficial to a people and it is beneficial to the whole. Every culture wants to be protected. And why shouldn't it be? I have this conversation with my friends all the time. Oh, well, if I say white power, then, you know, you get offended. But if you say black power, I'm supposed to like it. And I go, no, that's not the truth. I want you to say white power, but my question is, for the lifetime of this country, when you said white power, what did you mean by it? Well, I'll tell you what I mean by it. No, 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 no. What was it meant to signify? See, and that's where the consciousness comes in. Because consciousness forces you to look at those realities, but at the same time, it gives you the strength, the power through them, to burn those egotistical, those negatively egotistical concepts away, because ego can also be positive, ladies and gentlemen. Just to let you know that. But it burns off those negative egotistical values, and it replaces them with something greater. And that's what socialism requires. And this country just isn't that. We are literally, in 2021, still having an argument about if all lives matter. Because somebody said, you know, black lives matter. This shows the depravity of the culture here. Socialism requires us to have a full embrace of the fact that there is other people on the planet and in proximity to you in your country, and to embrace the fact that not only will they be different, but they must be different. That is what makes the country, that is what makes the society beautiful. It also says, it also puts a limit on the duplication principle. And what I mean by that is, it says, only where it is beneficial for the whole, for the society as it exists, at the ground level. See? I said for the whole, and all of you went to for the entire country. No, that is the beauty of the power of real indigenous socialism. Not hierarchical socialism, but indigenous socialism, where it comes naturally about. What it says is that if you are going to duplicate something, repeat it over and over and over and over again, it must fit the standards and needs of the place where it is duplicated. And this principle is taken from nature. A rose, yes, is still a rose. And a rose will always be a rose. And a rose may grow here where I'm at and there where you're at. But if it is left to nature, nature's going to adjust that rose to where it's planted. If it's left to nature, Nature will adjust that rose to where it's planted because there's different needs of that place where that rose is planted. Yes, the place wants a rose, but it may only be able to provide enough sustenance for that rose not to be red, but to be yellow or to be white or to maybe even come out a little bit pinkish red. I mean, do you understand what I'm talking about here? This is the depth of socialism. It is not a governing system. It is a life. It's not religion. It's deeper than that. It is a socio-cultural recognition that is almost at the heart of humanitarianism. And this country just doesn't have that depth to carry it out. In order to even be possible in this country, you would need a drastic elevation of intelligence in this country. And there's too many people committed to making sure that that doesn't happen to ensure that this will never happen. There's too many people who are dedicated to making sure that people's intelligence will not rise in this country to ensure that socialism will never, at least indigenous socialism, will never happen here. Moreover, and I think this is one of the most brilliant things that comes from understanding indigenous people and how they operate it, which is that socialism requires a circular plan for creating life's necessities and life's excesses. So what do I mean by life's necessities? Housing, if we're going to do electric, okay, fine. There has to be a way to do it where you're not killing things, where you're not putting trees and stuff in danger. And when I talk about life's excesses, and by the way, I would include as necessity, you know, like furniture, things like that, stuff that you might need to keep your house. But also, you know, when I talk about life's excesses, it's the things that you really don't need, but makes life easier. Having a circular planning process for all that, I kind of mentioned it in the beginning of this. Well, that drives home a commitment to living naturally in the soul. Because if you thought out what it's going to take to not only make this product good, but also to break it down as soon as its use is completed so that Mother Nature can reintegrate it into her system. Ladies and gentlemen, you're literally one with nature while you're still progressing the society forward. And look, a society doesn't have to be preoccupied with progressing itself forward. But for God's sakes, there's nothing that says that life can't be comfortable. And in fact, one might suggest, and I think at the heart of indigenous socialism, this is the point. Your civilization is determined by its final analysis creations. It's fine and good if you claim to be a high-minded civilization when you are still in the brush, when you're living as hunter-gatherers. But if you're given the tools to grow from being hunter-gatherers, If you're given the sun, if somebody descends down and gives you the sun and says, hey, this is taken from the sun, you can use this now to go from being hunter-gatherers to having everything that you want, everything that you need. Just use this and use it wisely. If you go from hunter-gatherers to a society which praises greed and praises destruction of people's communities, of people's, of exploiting people into their deaths. If you go from being hunter-gatherers to killing for sport animals simply by shooting them, you're not even giving them a chance to defend themselves because you're a coward. If you do that, you can't claim to be a high civilization. And ultimately, socialism started in Sweden, jeepers, sorry, started in Sweden, and it was showing a way for the rest of Europe to try to get Europe to turn itself away from its old habits. And I believe this because in the Hopi tradition, the mythology of the Hopi, the heart of Europe is in Sweden. It's in Sweden. That is where the Great Spirit set down the roots for the white race in Sweden. And thus, the cosmic plan emanates from Sweden. Europe didn't listen. And if you look at what the world has become with Europe running the show, whether from Europe or from the United States, you start to understand that we are now in a period of time where the shortcomings of Europe has put us on a collision course for disaster. And the only answers now is to change drastically or accept a disaster. The society doesn't change, this society especially doesn't change that fast. And that's why, yeah, I'm not calling myself a socialist anymore because I understand too well, what most Europeans mean by socialism, they do not mean Scandinavian socialism. They do not mean indigenous socialism. They mean a socialism that is built on hierarchy, one that they can exploit, one that they can take and use for their own benefit and grant it. One that more mimics Nazism than it does the indigenous socialism. And I want to give a great shout out to one of my ancestors who helped me understand this. I was talking to somebody about a year and a half ago, a little bit under a year and a half ago, and I was talking about being a socialist. And they recoiled, and they said, I didn't know you were a Nazi. And I'm like, what? Wait, what? Wait. No, the Nazis weren't even socialists. They just put it in there. And we actually had a bit of an argument about it. And, you know, I brought up some reference stuff that Hitler said and blah, 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 blah. And the person was like, no, they were real socialists. And the person was white. But months later, I was thinking about this. And, you know, most of the time when I tell people about socialism, they go back to the Nazis being socialists. And I'm like, well, that's just propaganda. Or is it? Maybe to Europeans, Nazism really was socialism. Maybe outside of Sweden, Nazism was what they perceived socialism to be. Not because of propaganda, but because in their hearts of hearts, they understood that that's what socialism would have to be in Europe. So my ancestor used to tell me, well, when before she was an ancestor, obviously, but she used to tell me, believe white people when they tell you who they are. And for years, I've been arguing against that argument because I didn't want it to be true. Well, I'm believing white people. They're telling me who white people are, and here's what I understand. Nazism is socialism to these people. And that's what it's going to be. That's what it's going to be. So yes, it's time that new dynamics are created. It's time that new systems are thought about. But I am abandoning calling myself a socialist. I will not call myself a socialist again. We need something new. Communism, the same thing. It's time to get over that label. We need something new. There's a reason why both of those systems failed. There's a reason. And truthfully, I believe that Dr. King had it right. Dr. King had it right. We need something new. And usually, when the time comes, the Most High gives us the answer that we need. And I believe we are on the cusp of having the answer that we need to what we should replace socialism and communism with. Hey, I'd love to know what you think about this. My name is Vyamir Adis. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, drop them to me. I am still your brother. I look forward to hearing from y'all. Let me know what you think about this. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick.